All right, welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 4. I think we're up to Lecture 4. That's where I count to. Before I get started, does anybody have any questions and queries about material or information that we've covered so far? Yes, I do have all your labs. Yes, they are going to get marked very soon. I know I said that last week, but I really am going to do it now because I've actually got the spreadsheet all set up with your names in it and everything. But if anybody got any other pending questions on either the content we covered last week or in the previous weeks, or any other question they would like to raise about data comms or anything at this particular point in time.
Is the lab for chapter 2, the end of chapter 2, I think it is?
There are chapter 2 labs, and the chapter 2 labs, I'll tell you what they are. I have them here. All of the labs that have been modified are actually sitting in the chapter folders, and that is how you figure out which ones you're doing. And there are labs for chapter 1, which I'm pretty sure you've completed. I've already got chapter 1 from chapter 2 labs from most students, Sabahattin. Have you not seen them?
No, I'm obviously a bit slow there. I'm still catching up gradually.
Okay, there are at least three activities for chapter 2. There is activity 2.2.5, 261, 262. They involve the use of Wireshark. And they are the three activities for chapter 2.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, I haven't seen the explanation for those yet, but I'll dig up the modified versions and start working on those.
Well, that's up to you. You'll find that they're all up on the QCAT site, as they have been for quite some time.
Yep.
Alrighty, let's get started on this stuff, and let's go through what is in chapter 3 and 4. I'll just silence Sting there, who's singing about very important things about the Cold War, but it's causing me to have difficulty concentrating, so... Okay. Module 3. Module 3 is... Okay, so basically what they do with this course is they work their way down through all layers of the OSI reference model. So when you get into Module 3, you do the application layer. When you get to Module 4, you do the presentation layer. Then Module 5, you do the session layer, and so on. All people seem to need data processing, is the way you remember which way they go, which is not as much fun as please do not throw sausage pizza away. And it sounds as though it was made up by a computer person, because I don't think all people do need data processing. But they'd have us believe that. But in fact, this one deals with the application layer and the presentation layer, because they tend to blur together to a certain degree. The applications talk to the application layer. This is a very important thing to realise. The applications talk to the applications layer. The applications do not exist at the application layer. They actually talk to the application layer. Then, when you go down through the application layer, down to the presentation layer, you end up with a situation where things go on in the presentation layer. Now, there are three primary functions for the presentation layer. Coding and conversion from application data. So, to ensure that data from the source device can reach the target device. Now, does anybody other than Sabahattin remember the old days when we used to use UUencode to get binaries through email because we didn't have MIME? Does anybody remember that? You'd recognise a UUencode because you'd see begin 644, Sting walking on the moon.mp3, and then there'd be piles and piles and piles of lines that start with a capital M and a whole lot of UUencoded nonsense, and then there'd be a grave accent line at the end, and then it would say end. In fact, and I wouldn't recommend this for general use, but modern email clients such as Outlook, Outlook Express, no, well, Outlook Express isn't that modern, Thunderbird, Eudora, et al., they actually have UU and code support. Now, just as a matter of morbid curiosity, does anybody know what one of the problems with UU and code was? No? Nobody knows what the problem with UU and code was?
I can't remember which one of the problems, because there were a few that I could remember, but do you mean size or character encoding or... can't remember.
One of the problems with UU encode was that because it used characters from the range 32 to 127 in the ASCII character set, it would not survive a character set conversion from ASCII to EBCDIC. So if you were sending files between IBM mainframes and other computers, you would have trouble with character set conversion on UU encode. Which is one of the reasons why MIME moved to Base64 encoding. Now, as much as it would be fun for me to sit down and explain to you how UU encoding and Base64 encoding works, it has absolutely nothing to do with this course, and it's probably of intellectual interest, but we're probably not going to go there. But effectively what happens in very brief terms is you take the input data of your binary file, you use either a table lookup or similar algorithm to convert it into printable only characters, and for example, Base64 uses the letters symbols 0 through 9, A through Z, uppercase, A through Z, lowercase, and plus and minus, and it encodes binary data into something that is 33, I think it's 33, or is it 25? 25, 33% bigger than the original file. Has anybody ever noticed that when you attach a file to a message, the actual attachment is bigger than the file you attached? Has anybody seen that? Or has nobody ever really paid that much attention?
Yeah.
Well, that is an artifact. Yeah, it's on the order of magnitude of 25 to 33%. So I'll argue with you and say that that's a bit more than marginal, but that's okay. When you attach, and this is important because when you actually look at a mail server's file size limit, the file size limit on the mail server, which is set to 3 meg or 4 meg or 5 meg or 20 meg, is actually the size of the encoded data, which is why you can't actually get 20 meg of file through the mail server. You have to drop the size to 15 or 16 meg. I don't know whether we've got people old enough here to remember when we used to slice things into 64K chunks and shovel them over Usenet. It was certainly when I was a lot younger, I can tell you. Okay, so that's character set. Well, that's one of the issues of character set conversion that can... and FidoNet, yes. I can't remember how they shoveled data around FidoNet. That'll be a trip down memory lane if we look that up. But yes, it did have an encoding system to pass binaries over Echomail. I think I told everybody my dream was running a FidoNet point system, and I never quite got to it. But that's okay. Another thing that can happen at the presentation layer is you can look at compression of data. And compression is the procedure of running some sort of mathematical tomfoolery across data to remove redundant information and to send the data in a size that uses a reduced number of symbols and theoretically takes up less space. Just imagine how big Bookshare would need to be if they didn't zip their files up first. Just putting a topical example in there. Encryption and decryption of data for transmission and reception. So you're looking at those sorts of things. Now, interestingly enough, I'm sure Sabahattin will be correct me here, but as far as I recollect, IPsec and SIPE, which was another implementation of your encryption and stuff over IP were add-on bolted on to IPv4. But as far as I recollect, encryption and compression are actually part of the IPv6 standard.
Well, the header formats are, I think that it's still like optional to the implementer, but as long as it's recognized, so yeah, basically IPv4 had it tacked on.
Yeah, and if anybody has ever tried to get an IPsec VPN going, you'll understand what a tedious mess is to get going. Okay, so that's essentially what the presentation layer does. Has anybody got any questions on any of that or comments that they'd like to add? Alrighty. Okay. Now, for some reason, and I think this was the order in which stuff was covered in the module. Oh, if you guys ever are wondering where I got my notes from, oh, did everybody get the new passwords to access the curricula on QCAT.org? Does everybody have the new password for the curricula on QCAT.org?
No.
Oh, well, you were supposed to email me for it. Does your chat work on the Mac? Because I'm not going to say it on lecture. I can type it into chat, though.
Yeah, I'll open it now. Hang on.
Alrighty, here we go. And the password is... that. And that will get you access into the curriculum on QCAT. Now, you can still read the curriculum through Netacad, which a lot of you probably realised. If you actually log into your Net account, the Netacad account, you will be able to, you will actually be able to pull up the curriculum from your profile. However, I must warn everybody, if you choose to take the exams on Safari on the Mac and it falls over, please don't expect any sympathy from us. Well, you'll get some sympathy, but that's about all you're going to get. We'll just reset your exam activation and you get to do it on Internet Explorer. Or something else. Or you get... yeah, pretty much. Safari's like that, actually. It's gotten better. But it's gotten a lot better, but I can't... And I don't want to dwell on this too much, but I cannot express the level of disappointment I experienced when I fired up Safari on my Mac, went into Wikipedia, and found the entire browsing experience rather unpleasant. I then toddled off back to Windows. Okay, so we're going to cover a couple of the protocols in TCP/IP. Now, we've already discussed that TCP/IP is a protocol suite. Now, a protocol suite is a series of protocols that interoperate. And that, just give me 5 seconds. I'm just going to walk over and shut the door. I'll be back in a sec. Sorry about that. That stayed. Did that stay keyed, or did that actually key down when I walked away? It probably just keyed up when I picked it up. Okay. So a protocol suite is a series of protocols that interoperate together and provide a suite of services to applications and programs running in that infrastructure. And TCP/IP is now the most commonly implemented protocol worldwide. Very, very popular. Does anybody remember back to the days when we used to use IPX, SPX, LANtastic, and all of those other interesting protocols that were around for a while, NetBUI? Yeah, and I remember, I mean, it's interesting. Windows 95 was the first operating system to include TCP/IP in its default set of bundled protocols. Oh, I might be wrong on that. Did NT4 come out before? Well, okay. Windows 95 was the first desktop operating system. to bundle TCP/IP in as a standard protocol in a Windows-based operating system. So you could get bolt-on add-ons for Windows for Workgroups 3.1 and 3.11, because Windows for Workgroups 3.1 and 3.11 spoke IPX, SPX by default and NetBUI by default, but you actually had... You added a WinSock stack, or you used Microsoft's... there was one that Microsoft had for Ethernet, and then you would get Trumpet WinSock or something. We didn't call it Trumpet WinSock. We changed one of the letters in Trumpet WinSock because unless you configured it properly, it certainly did. And I think that was written by a bloke in... We had a bloke... I think it was written by a bloke in Tasmania, if my memory serves me correctly. Yeah, that was the bad old... Well... good/bad old days of internet access when we're all running Netscape 1.1 and 1.0 and I don't know whether anybody remembers, but not that anybody ever paid for it, but does anybody remember that Netscape actually used to cost $50 and the only way you were supposed to get it for free was if you were educational or academic, so everybody turned into being academic and educational as far as Netscape was concerned? Yeah. Unfortunately, eSpeak... didn't do a good job of your French there, so I'm not sure what you said, but that's okay. Yeah, it was $50. It was $50 to buy the browser, and then when Microsoft released Internet Explorer 1 or 2 into the operating system, there was all that antitrust stuff, and then there was all the Java antitrust stuff, and then there was some more antitrust stuff. Oh, now. This is something I actually am going to answer mention because it is somewhat relevant. Has anybody here been bitten by an automatic upgrade to Internet Explorer 9?
No, I do all my upgrades manually.
Ah, okay. Well, you need to install... Well, you don't need to. You should install the blocker tool to make sure that Microsoft doesn't sneak it onto your computer. There is a blocker tool from Microsoft that will prevent any automatic or semi-automatic upgrades to Internet Explorer 9. Unless, of course, you want to run Internet Explorer 9. But apparently somebody I know had Internet Explorer 9 hoisted on them from automatic updates, and they uninstalled it, and they lost Internet Explorer altogether. So they did a start run iExplorer, and it went bink, and then they put a URL into the address box, and it went bink, and they had no Internet Explorer altogether. So thank you, DOJ. You have given us the ability to completely uninstall Internet Explorer. But you, if you don't have something else installed set as your default browser, you're not going to browse too many websites.
Doesn't uninstalling Windows or Internet Explorer, not Windows Explorer, break Windows? It seems to me I read that somewhere, or is that a fiction?
It doesn't anymore. You never used to be able to uninstall Internet Explorer. But you can now. There was always a version of Internet Explorer distributed with the operating systems. And then I think... I don't know whether anybody remembers, but they started pulling the Java virtual machines out of the operating systems, and then Microsoft stopped distributing the Java virtual machine, and then Sun jumped up and down, and Microsoft jumped up and down, and they all jumped up and down. But if you... if you uninstall Internet Explorer, I don't think it's fatal. It's just not very pleasant because there are other bits of the operating system that tend to like seeing Internet Explorer around.
Yeah, we've got the browser choice thing.
Yeah, well, keep in mind that uninstalling Explorer and uninstalling Internet Explorer are two different things. Explorer is... the thing that lets you browse all your file systems and stuff. And Internet Explorer is obviously the internet-y thing, but they do actually have some common code. So if you go in and hack it out of the registry because you read some cool article on annoyances.org, you're probably going to end up with a broken system unless you know exactly what you're doing. But, of course, you've all got backups, so that's not a worry. Hey, cool. Okie dokie. So we're looking at various protocols. We have DNS, which resolves IP addresses to host names, and host names to IP addresses, and it can resolve other sorts of records, but we're not going to go into that. Alright, are somebody other than Sabahattin, because I definitely know he knows the answer, can somebody tell me why do you need to specify your DNS servers numerically?
I don't know.
Okay. Oh, well, you should know, Sabahattin. Do you know why you've got to specify them? You should know why you've got to specify them numerically.
Yeah, because there's no other way of resolving their names until you specify at least one machine to find the names from.
Exactly, you have a chicken and egg problem.
It
would be recursive.
Yes, it's a recursive problem. How do you look up the name of the name server that you don't have the address of a name server to look after? That's like that stupid joke I once heard that was knock knock, who's there? This is a recursive knock knock joke. This is a recursive knock knock joke, who? Knock knock. Okay, moving right along. Yeah, something like that. So you end up with a situation where sorry, my train of thought just derailed. Yeah, you have to specify your DNSs numerically. And that is because once you've actually got a DNS server into your machines, you can then resolve names to IP addresses, www.fassabook.com and similar. There are, of course, automatic ways of handing out DNS configurations such as zeroconf, Avahi, DHCP, etc. I think I've got most of the main ones, but you still have to tell the auto configuration mechanisms the number for your DNS server or it doesn't work. Okay, so some other common protocols. We've got HTTP, Hypertext Transfer Protocol, which transports the pages of the World Wide Web. I feel old because I remember back in 1993-1994, NCSA had New Site of the Week and there were like 50 pages on the World Wide Web and you could go visit all of them if you wanted. Does anybody remember Gopher, just out of morbid curiosity, before we move on? Okay, cool. It's still up. There are places that's... Sorry, go ahead, Charlene, sorry.
I went online in 96, and it was a lot bigger than in 93, but my university still did go for certain things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are still some corners of the internet that still do Gopher. SMTP, that sends mail around, hands it between servers. Just one of my little bugbears. If you send a message to one of our mail servers and it bounces, and you have any intention of telling me that it has bounced, and you don't have the bounce message or you haven't read it, please do not expect a happy, smiley response from your resident postmaster. Well, I'll just probably go, that's nice, and go on with my day. And it's very important, and I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir here, that if you get a bounce message from somewhere, and it matters to you the fact that the message bounced, that you at least read the bounce message and find out why, rather than just going, oh, it bounced, and I deleted the bounce message, of course. And, I just wanted to tell you that your message had bounced. That's like... Sorry, go ahead, Charlene.
Don't mean to interrupt, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's what the chat's for.
I just wanted to know, I think it says in the notes that POP, I'm going to get this backwards, POP is application layer and SMTP is presentation layer?
I really hope it doesn't say that in the notes.
It maybe doesn't, but it seemed to, because I remember wondering about it, so it probably doesn't.
No, I think it says that SMTP is transport layer and POP is application layer. Does that sound right?
Transport, yeah, that's right. Sorry, Dippy. I just wondered why they were different.
That's just how they've decided to break them down. If you get like 20 OSI network layer reference model experts in a room and get them to argue about which things exist at certain layers, there'll be a bit of a punch-up while they all figure out what goes at what layer, and they will all never agree. I suppose... Yeah, look at... I don't know, where would you split that, Sabahat? And I'm sort of saying there's a grey area there, because is SMTP a transport protocol, or is the fact that it sends mail between MTAs define it as an application layer protocol? You've got to love these reference models.
Or a session protocol, given that it has transactions and sessions and... yeah, I don't know, I prefer not to comment, or indeed to support the OSI model generally.
Well, yes, okay, fair enough. So we don't really know on that particular point. I shall ask some people that are differently knowledgeable than I, and we shall find out what they say. You can't always pigeonhole services and applications into one layer of the OSI reference model. A lot of people would like it if you could, and a lot of teaching models think that you can, but it's like that stupid thing where bananas are herb and stuff like that. You know, it's not always as simple as it looks.
I guess that makes sense, since it's a theoretical construct and not an actual one, that things don't always theoretically fit.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. And if you want to get Sabahattin's blood pressure up to dangerous levels, you can tell him that it does and that the OSI reference model is awesome. And that should be quite successful. And in fact, I would probably be similarly afflicted. Between theoretical and practice, there is certainly an incongruency. Okay. Telnet. I'm sure we've all seen Telnet. It's used to talk to... networking devices. It is a network teletype, basically, and you can type and receive information from devices, and anybody who's played MUDs, you've all used Telnet. FTP, interactive file transfer between systems. Everybody keeps asking me for an FTP server for QCAT. No, 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 and no. Okay, glad we've got that out of the way. Okay, that's the end of Module 3. But I still have Module 4 notes here, which I'm quite happy to go into. Any questions on any of that stuff or comments on any of that stuff so far? Is everybody still awake?
Yeah, I'm awake. I had a quick business housekeeping question.
Yes, by all means.
Should we hold off on doing any more of the labs and so on until we hear from you?
Yeah. Has anyone started on Module 3 labs yet?
Not yet.
Okay, well, you can always submit what you've done. I will have an answer in the next day or two. So if you feel that you want to... if you want to hold off on doing any more labs at this point, you can do that, and I will have an answer for you in a day or two. But if you want to continue working, I will always mark the labs that you've worked on. In fact, if you go and complete all of the labs, I will mark them off, and they will go in the gradebook. And if you complete all of the exams, I will pass you on the course. That's how it works. It's insecure, and blind people really know how to leech stuff off FTP sites, and I'd rather they didn't. Has anyone ever noticed that? Blind people are like pack rats. Oh, there's 15 gig of ebooks. I'll just download the lot. And they do. They download everything. And then you're just like, oh, that was the smoke pouring out of my router, and my site will never be the same again. And then if you put... hang on. What? You're saying that's why blind people do that. No, no, they don't. They've all got Free Download Manager and GetRight and FlashGot and BitComet and Hammer My Link 7.6 Professional. No, that last one doesn't exist, honestly. All right, let's continue on with lecture. But it is... I suppose it's human nature to hoard. But I just wish people would realise that generally speaking, the internet isn't going away anytime soon, we hope. I don't care. What stops you from doing a recursive rget? A wget, I should say. Doesn't make any difference.
Well, the same amount of data is transferred. I wouldn't want to hug you if you're... If you're genuinely sort of bad... Well, there's always async, I suppose.
We are bandwidth metered, and we are bandwidth capped, and you do not need a mirror of qcat.org. If you would like a mirror of qcat.org, please consider posting me a hard drive of at least 40 gigabytes in size, and I will be more than happy to give you a mirror of the whole blinkin' site.
I'll stick with what we've
done. Quite honestly, the only reason I use... No, it's not poking at you, I'm just saying. The only reason I use BitComet is because it's the only thing that'll deal with my crappy connection and not error file one.
Oh, no, that's okay, I just put BitComet in because I knew it was one of the ones you used, and I had to cover the one you used just because that's the sort of person I am. But there are about five or six different programs that do mass downloadings, you know, Free Download Manager, FlashGet, what is it, FlashGot, FileZilla, all those sorts of things. And people find those somewhat useful. So yes, if you would like a complete copy of the qcat.org website, you either need to pay us the postage so that we can send you 4 or 5 DVDs, or you need to send us a hard drive or give us the money for same, and we will be more than happy to ship you the entire contents of the QCAT website. Easy. Actually, no, you don't get the curriculum. You get everything else, but you don't get the curriculums. So that's... people suddenly get a bit not so excited about it once we tell them that. Alrighty, any other queries, questions before we move on? Alright, moving on. We're now going to talk about the transport layer, which is layer 4 of the OSI reference model. I might actually just wait a second and she'll come back. That's probably a good idea, actually. Or maybe not, so let's continue. Transport layer is responsible for end-to-end transport of data and the integrity of that data. So when we talk about end-to-end transport of data, which is what the transport layer is all about, just re-paraphrasing that, we're talking about things like TCP, which has a reliable end-to-end transport of data. One of the things to understand about the TCP/IP protocol suite, or IP specifically, which is Internet Protocol, is that it is best effort transmission. It will do its best to get data from one end of the network to the other, but IP itself doesn't guarantee that the data is going to get from end to end. Probabilistically, there is a very high probability that the data is going to get from one end to the other. However, it's not guaranteed. It's a bit like the fact that you can actually get the same cyclic redundancy check for two different blocks of data. It's theoretically possible, but highly improbable. Charlene.
Sorry, me again. I just wanted to know what is, because I was looking at the Wireshark thing, and I was like, I have an incredible amount of errors. I wanted to know, if you're looking at that, what the ratio of errors to good packets should be, in an ideal world, obviously.
Are they the ones that say the checksum fails? Because I've wondered that myself.
Yeah, or like bad, I'd have to look at it again, but I just saw a lot of ones that said they weren't any good in some way, shape, or form.
You got any insights on that one, Sabat? Really? She said, why are there so many errors showing up in her Wireshark? She's seeing piles and piles of errors or packets that aren't good for some reason. I don't know whether the checksums fail or something like that.
Probably because of offloading in the NIC.
Ah, yes. That would make sense. Basically what happens is when you... Yeah, actually, that does make perfect sense. A lot of modern networking hardware calculates the... Ethernet calculates the CRCs for the frames anyway. But a lot of newer networking hardware has what we call TCP offload. And the TCP offload is responsible for calculating the error checking information for TCP, and that is actually done on the network card to relieve the burden from the CPU. And when the packets are handed up to the upper layers, if the offloading has already happened, those packets will show up as erroneous, perhaps. I believe Sabahattin, but I would also have a dig around on the Wireshark forums, because they'll probably be quite educational on this particular point.
Thank you, and now I'll shut up for a while.
Oh, promises. Okay. Okay, the transport layer enables multiple applications to communicate over the network using a single device. Ensures, if required, that all data is received in order and correctly by the specific application. Employs error handling mechanisms. And it prepares data for transmission over the network. Now, the transport layer is also responsible for breaking data into segments. So segments are your transport layer PDU unit. I shouldn't really say PDU unit, it's like ATM machine and CD disk. Okay, so segments are your transport layer PDU. And it also organizes which application receives which data. Does anybody know what mechanism does the transport layer utilize in TCP/IP to ensure that the correct application gets the correct data? Yes, port numbers. Port numbers is absolutely correct. I'm pretty sure one of these labs got you to do this, or at least one of the later labs does. That's okay. We can deal with that. We can figure out what an aut number is. Has anybody ever run netstat on their computer and looked at the connections that are currently open? Alrighty, well, if you were to run netstat now, you would actually find that there is a connection to port 4031 of v47.darkstarllc.com. Can anybody theorize what that connection might be for? Yes, it is one of the connections for Ventrilo. Okie dokie. Now, where was I up to? That was odd. Now, No, UDP uses port numbers as well, and ICMP has type codes. No, it uses about six different ports. In fact, it uses port 4031 for one of its bits of stuff, and it uses TCP and it uses UDP, and then it uses a connection on port 6100, which is apparently tagged as SynchroDB, and then there's another port that it phones home to the Ventrilo main server when you do a connection somewhere on Flagstaff system. So, I don't know, if you've got nothing better to do, you and a packet tracer application and Ventrilo can have fun. Okay, now it's fair to say that applications do not need to understand specifics of the network at the transport layer. They are just concerned with getting their data on and off the network. Now TCP/IP, TCP and UDP and ICMP uses port numbers to differentiate between the conversations. Have I had the discussion yet about what a socket is? I'd probably better get to it then, hadn't I? So if you look at... Oh, waking up would be a good look. If you look at how TCP functions or how TCP and UDP functions, each connection is basically made up of two portions. The source end of the connection is has a source IP address and a source port. And the destination of the other end of the connection has a destination IP and a destination port. And once you have both of these things set up, you have a TCP connection. So say, for example, you are making connections to websites. And I'm going to keep this fairly simple, but say, for example, you open a connection to www.google.com. So you get source IP of your machine or your router anyway, and a source port of 1080 connects to www.google.com on port 80, and you make another connection to www.google.com from the same computer. So you get another connection from port 1081 on your local IP address to www.google.com on port 80. This is how the TCP stack differentiates between multiple connections from the same machine. Are there any questions on that? Or... does anyone want to ask anything about that? So, to be unique, a connection has a socket pair. Source IP, source port, destination IP, destination port. And once you have the socket pair, you can uniquely identify a TCP/IP connection. Sadly, relevant, given recent weeks. Now, this is important because when you're using T-Shark or other packet sniffing tools, by limiting what ports and what IP addresses you're actually going to sniff data for, you will greatly reduce the amount of traffic in your network logs. So writing efficient filters will greatly limit the data that you need to sift through. Okay, now data is segmented to prevent monopolization of the network by various applications. If we didn't break the data into segments, it wouldn't share down in a nice way, and you wouldn't get even distribution of data across the network. I was just about to ask a silly question. It still doesn't work perfectly, but everybody has had their network, well, not everybody, but most of you have had your network hammered by somebody BitTorrenting, either you or somebody else on your network, and you find that you can't make Skype calls that sound any good, or you can't get your email or something like that. Okay, that works to a degree. But if you listen to my two Cavicasts on QoS, you will also understand that if you once you've received packets from your ISP, the only remedy you have for those packets is to drop them. And if you have an incredible amount of UDP traffic coming in from the internet, you can throw them away, but there's basically nothing you can do about UDP traffic flooding your connection, even if you are using QoS. So watch out for that one. QoS can certainly make a big difference, though. Okay, one of the things that TCP provides are connection-oriented conversations, reliable delivery, ordered data reconstruction. In other words, the packets can actually turn up out of order and TCP will resequence them for you so that you get a coherent stream of data. Flow control, in other words, regulating the flow of data across links. And you look into things like window scaling and windows and slow start and Vegas algorithms and all of those fun things that you can look up on Wikipedia and get yourself very confused about. Because data can arrive at different times by different paths, TCP needs to reorder data and reassemble it into a coherent stream. So now TCP is end-to-end, in other words, it's from your source to your destination. Reliable, relatively speaking, it's pretty reliable. Handles error correction and packet retransmission. UDP, which is User Datagram Protocol, is fire and forget, low overhead, and no acknowledgement. So basically, it's a bit like firing a cannon at something, and there's a big boom and a whole pile of smoke, and you don't actually know whether the cannonball hit its target or not. I don't know why you wouldn't know that, but that's just a silly example, and we'll just leave that one right there. But essentially, you send the packet off, and there's a high probability it's going to get to where you sent it, but it's certainly not guaranteed with UDP. Pieces of data in UDP are called datagrams. When they talk about low overhead, the TCP header is 20 bytes long because it's got sequence information and window size and a whole lot of other things, and the UDP packets header is 8 bytes long. Any questions on any of that so far? Any comments? Anything anybody wants to add? Alrighty. Now they've basically got a breakdown of port addresses here. They've got well-known server ports, 0 to 1023. They are ports that are registered by the IANA, Internet Assigned Numbers Authority. I think that's who does them. And EP. Okay, well, they keep changing the letters. Why do they have to keep doing that? Oh, yep. Okay. I was going to say, why do they have to keep changing the letters? What is it now? The exceedingly tedious protocol assignment authority or something? So basically, they are things like ports for... things like World Wide Web 80, POP 3 110, IMAP 143, 443s for HTTPS. Now, to listen on a port that is below 1024 or 1023 or lower generally requires administrative privilege on an operating system. So if you want to listen on a port like 80, whatever it is that you're running needs some form of administrator privilege to actually fire up and listen on those ports. You've got registered ports 1024 to 49151, which are ports that you can use to talk to various things. What about Windows?
Does it actually prevent you from binding to load number ports? I'm pretty sure that last time I tried it didn't seem to mind.
Yes, it does. If you're running as a regular user, not an administrator, you will not be able to bind a low port.
Oh, really? Oh, great. Excellent.
You can say a lot of nasty things about Microsoft, and people often do, but one of the things that Microsoft has done a pretty damn good job on is their TCP/IP stack.
I think it's just a BSD stack, isn't it? Except they ripped out raw sockets recently.
No, large portions of it were re-implemented. And if you actually read the Microsoft tech documentation, you will find that large portions of the stack were re-implemented over the years of evolution, and it certainly bears very little resemblance to the BSD stack that it was in, say, 1993.
Ah, right, okay. Great.
Well, if you didn't come to this course and learn something, I'd be wasting my time. Now, 49152 to 65536, they're dynamic ports assigned to applications, so they're not actually officially locked down onto anything. And I need to discuss netstat usage, which I already did, so I don't have to. Okay, so they are basically how the ports break down. So generally speaking, if you allocate if you're a non-admin user or you're allocating a source port, your source ports are generally going to be allocated from the range 1024 through to 49151. And there are various registry tweaks you can do to decide where those port ranges are actually being allocated. If you, however, do those registry tweaks and you break your system, you get to keep both pieces. Now, it's worth mentioning that TCP uses sequence numbers and acknowledgement numbers. TCP must create a session between two hosts for communication. So you need to actually set the session up, and once the session is set up, communication can occur, and then once communication is complete, the session is torn down. Sequence number is actually the last byte that the host has sent. And the ACK number is the last byte that the host has received. Sorry, no. Blah. Sequence number is the last byte that the host has sent, and the ACK number is the next byte that the host expects to receive. So, does this chapter, I'm just trying to remember because I haven't read further down in my note, does this chapter go into the mechanics of the three-way handshake? Well, if it doesn't, I'm not going to quite yet. This is chapter 3. This is just chapter 3. Hang on. We're on chapter 4. We're still on chapter 4.
This is chapter 4. Oh. Yeah, I haven't read 4. I've only read 3 at the moment.
Oh, that's okay. It's all right. No harm done. So we'll just keep talking about what's in these notes, and then we will... So only one application can listen on a particular port on a server. I keep having to explain this to web developers. So can we have, like, we've got like one IP address, right? Can we have like 7 web servers all listening on port 80? No. But we've got 7 web servers. Can we have them all listening on port 80? No. So what you actually need to do in that situation is set up a reverse proxy and organize which goes to the 7 web servers sitting behind the one IP address. No, you cannot have 7 web servers listening on port 80. Because only one service can listen on a particular port per IP. Yes, you can pull nasty tricks with proxying and messing around with the contents of packets to make it look as though you can have more than one, but I'm not talking about that today. Oh, here we are. Three-way handshake. Look at that. Walked into it like a brick wall. When you establish a connection with TCP, it basically does a three-way handshake. So the first packet that is sent is a synchronization packet. So the client sends a SYN packet with a sequence number. The sequence number is usually randomized. The server sends an acknowledgement with a sequence number one higher than the initial sequence number. And then the client sends an acknowledgement with a sequence number one higher than that again. Keep in mind that this happens in both directions simultaneously, so you end up with two sets of differing sequence numbers depending on in which direction the data is being transmitted. The sequence number is randomly chosen, generally speaking, at connection establishment, or at least the start of the range is randomly chosen to prevent people from guessing sequence numbers. I would recommend the book, I think it's called The Art of Deception by Kevin Mitnick, and if my memory serves, Bookshare has a copy. He used sequence numbers to attack Nakamoto's or something or other, some Japanese name that I can't remember, that guy's computer. I think his book is called The Art of Deception, and the other one is called Takedown, if my memory serves me. Nakamura's book is called Takedown. Another good book that's worth reading is The Hacker Crackdown. It's a bit dated now, but that was also another good book that I read, and I think it's available freely online somewhere. Now, the other thing they're saying is the sequence number is randomly incremented for each byte sent. Now, basically all segments are held in a buffer until all of the segments in a particular order are received. So in other words, if you've got segments 321, 330, 326, 325, 328, 327, 324, 323, 322, and 329, it will hold on to all of the segments between 321 and 330, and when all of those segments have been received, it will hand the resulting set of segments in order up to the application. And it's saying that this buffer should be as big as the window size for the session. Now, on modern computing hardware, this isn't an issue, but it was possible to crash limited memory computers by setting window sizes to something bigger than the amount of RAM they had, and it caused all sorts of nastiness. It is also possible, if you're using a recent enough version of the TCP stack and both peers support it, that you can actually do selective acknowledgement. And selective acknowledgement means you can acknowledge certain portions of the data transmission, and you don't have to acknowledge everything, which allows things, can make things faster. If a segment is not acknowledged, it is resent with an exponential back-off timer, which means that the more times it can't be sent, the longer and longer between the retransmits. This is to stop packets that are not being received from congesting network links. Now, the good thing with selective acknowledgement is that you can say, look, I got segments 37, 40, 41, 42, and 46, and the system knows that it needs to send 38, 39, 44, 45, etc., so you can actually have a selective retransmit of the segments that weren't received. Window size can grow and shrink depending on network conditions. And how what the error rates are and stuff. Depending on what sort of networks and stuff you're working on, can certainly decide what sort of error rates and how much trouble you're having. Just hang on, I'm going to take a swig of tea. Any questions, any comments, any queries?
So let me get this right. If you don't have selective acknowledgement on, and you get one packet error in a window, it would retransmit the whole window, but if you have it off, it just retransmits the packets in the window that were not acknowledged?
Almost. What happens is it has to retransmit the packets. So what happens is in TCP, what you actually have is what we call a sliding window. So, say for example, you acknowledge, you send packets 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You get acknowledgements back for packets 1, 2, and 3. You then have to retransmit packets 4 and 5. Because you haven't got acknowledgements for packets 4 and 5. Then you can transmit 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And if you get acknowledgements for... Well, that's a good question. I'm going to have to look up the specifics of that, because if you get acknowledgements for 8, 9, and 10, I think you would have to retransmit the missing packets in the window, and I don't know whether that would mean retransmitting the entire window. Do you have the technical answer for that on hand, Sabahattin, or not?
If you're using selective acknowledgements, then you can just send the missing bits, as long as it's within the timeout window. As long as it's within the window for the timeout on each segment. So in other words, basically send it in time. Otherwise, the application is just going to sit there waiting for you to send the remaining portions. But I think if you don't have selective acknowledgements, you can only use the last sequence number. So in other words, you'll have to resend the whole lot. But I think it's all there in the RFC somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure it's all there in the RFCs, but that doesn't answer Mike's question in a timely manner. So I think you're right. But I think the sequence numbers, if you don't have selective acknowledgement, the... sequence numbers need to increment, and the sliding window allows you to acknowledge a number of packets at a time, which improves transfer efficiency. However, you can only acknowledge sequentially and up to the packets that you've actually received.
Yeah, that sounds about right, yeah.
Right, I think I understand where you're going with that. So, yeah, I see. So that means that when the window had slid over, in your example, to do the 6, 7, and 8, as well as requesting retransmission of 4 and 5, then it would need, if 4 and 5 didn't then get acknowledged the second trip around, it would need to request a whole bunch all over again before it could slide the window further along. I think I see where you're going with that. Is that a correct understanding?
Yes, it certainly is. Your sequence numbers must always be incrementing, and you, without selective acknowledgement, you cannot increment beyond the last sequence number that you've received, so you end up not being able to slide the window unless the packets arrive. Good news for you, though. Selective acknowledgement, I think, has been in the stack since Windows XP?
Off by default, unless negotiated by a server.
Yes, that's certainly true, but a lot of servers would negotiate that these days, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they should do. Anything with NT and Linux will.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure XP and up will use that. Most of the funky features in the TCP stack are optional but enabled by default. And you can actually go into the registry with Dr. TCP and change a whole lot of settings to decide whether they're actually officially turned on or off. But generally speaking, Microsoft does the right thing most of the time. There are certain... Well, I don't know, you might have seen this. Apparently the windowing algorithms on at least Windows XP, I'm not sure about Vista and 7, sometimes need tweaking for high bandwidth links. Like if you've got 40, 50 megabit links, you need to do some tweaking on them.
It's Vista and 7 that enabled the dynamic receive window. I think everything lower than that, it was based on the interface. So if it was a LAN, it would give you a conservative 64K or something like that.
Yeah, I remember doing some Googling on it a long time ago, and I saw some documentation that seemed to... Yeah, that's right. So if you're running XP or whatever, you would... you could go in and turn these things on, and in certain limited circumstances you would see significant improvements on your network connections. Yeah, I apologize about that. We sort of wandered around on the garden path a bit there, but all somewhat interesting and relatively relevant. Okay, now we're getting on to the network layer, so I'm going to stop here. Does anybody have any questions, queries, comments, etc.? Because I don't really want to go onto the network layer this week.